So our goal this morning is to try to look at Pesach and the Haggadah in perhaps a way that we haven't looked at in the past. And doing that using the Holocaust, the Shoah, as our guide. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at four different stations, and at each one we're going to reflect on some primary sources, which I have here. And the goal is to hopefully come to appreciate our own Yiddishkeit based on the just overwhelmingly unbelievable experience and devotion and dedication of people who came before us. So I want to begin at this table, specifically here, with some fascinating questions, because these questions kind of reflect two motifs that come up at the Seder that go together. And it kind of, the truth is, it really covers everything. In one of these volumes, I think it was in this volume by Yaffa Eliach, but they quote from the great Kloisenberger Rebbe of blessed memory, the Rebbe Kusil Yehuda Halberstam, who says that, you know what the greatest miracle is? He says, the greatest miracle of all, after everything that he went through between the death camp and the Moldorf Forest and everything else, he says that we still believe, that we still have a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So on one hand, there's the miracle aspect of the Seder. On the other hand, there's the emuna aspect of the Seder. And it all kind of comes together on this table. I'm sharing with you here the type of dedication and commitment that's almost superhuman that exists on this table. Right here you have three copies of three different responsa. I want to thank Annette Frankenthal, who is one of the docents at the Illinois Holocaust Museum, who translated. If you look on the back, there's a little translation of each of the questions that came up. So I want to begin. Let's start with this one, this sideways one. This section that we're, this table is the section of responsa of Shelos and Tshuvos. So this Shiloh and Tshuva Sefer is called Shiloh and Tshuvos Mimamakim. It's what I'm holding in front of you. It's authored by a great rabbinic figure from the Holocaust. His name is Rav Ephraim Oshri. Rav Oshri was in the Kovno ghetto, where he had a couple of little scraps of paper where he was able to jot down the questions that were asked from him. And miraculously, he survived. He came to New York. He published multiple volumes of Tshuvas. The one that you're looking at in front of you is the first volume of Shalos of Tshuvas, Mimamakim, from the depths. These are his original questions that he wrote down on scraps, risked his life to go back to Lithuania to get, and then he published them. The answers are amazing, but what's more amazing than the answers are the questions. So I want to share with you three questions. The first one is from this Sefer, from the Shalos of Tshuvas, Mimamakim. B'din chometz she'over alav ha-Pesach. What was the question? It's before Pesach, 1943, in the Kovno ghetto. So Kovno is right nearby Vilna. It's one of the most prominent cities in terms of Jewish scholarship in all of Eastern Europe. Kovno had the first major kollel, and they had great rabbinic figures. Befroos ha-Pesach, it was right before Pesach of 1943, Sholcho ha-Germanim yimach shemam le-ghetto Kovno es michsas ha-lechem shohayu noagim lechalik le-yehudim be-emtzaus ha Alson Roth. They sent us our quantity of bread for several weeks. And what did the people want to know? They wanted to know the following most unbelievable shaila. They said, here's the problem. We're going to go to a local goy and sell our chametz. It's not going to work. It's too dangerous. And if the goyim, the local Lithuanians, knew that we had bread, they'd be all over it. So we can't sell the bread, but we're not going to eat all of it over Pesach. So the shaila is, what's the question? What happens if we are mevatel the chametz, we just leave it there, but according to the Shulchan Aruch, it becomes prohibited after Pesach. You can't keep chametz in your house, even if you're mevatel it, even if you nullify it. Once you have the chametz, there's an isra of chametz she'ovel av Pesach. So the Jews want to know, listen to this, it's a chumra midrabbanan, it's a gzeira midrabbanan not to allow chametz from after Pesach, and the Jews want to know what they should do about the bread that they have left over in the rations. Unbelievable. Now he has an answer where they were allowed to do this, and be mafkirit, etc. But the question to me was mind-boggling. Second question I'll bring to your attention is from the kind of like the more old school crimpled type of paper.
I don't know if I have it anymore.
If you look on the blue sideways paper, it says Childs and Chuvas Makachi Hashem. This came from the collection of Chuvas. Actually, it's upside, straight up. This Chuva was published by a Chicagoan, a great Rav who I never met, of course, but his name was Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meisels, known as the Weizner Rav. The Weizner Rav was here in Chicago, published this work. In the introduction of this work called Mekatzeh Hashem, you have a very hair-raising description of his life, including his time in Auschwitz. He was a Hungarian Rav, which is why he didn't get taken away until 1944. Most of the Jews in Hungary were spared until the spring and the summer of 1944. But what's interesting about this volume of responsa is that it's not only his responsa. There were other rabbis who were living in Hungary and Slovakia and that area who were murdered by the Nazis who had correspondence, Nitra and other places. And he collected some of those. So this responsa, this question, is not his responsa. It's authored, if you look on the second page, on the back page, it's authored by Rav Nosson Greenberg, the Av Bezdim of Kazmark, and it's written to Rav Chananya Yom Tov Deitch of Dabshina. It's probably also some giant Hungarian metropolis. Just kidding. What's the question here? And it relates to Rabbi Engel's drasha yesterday. He says, we have a problem. He writes to the rabbi. This is one rabbi writing to a senior rabbi. What do we do about baking matzah? Now, in Hungary, in 1943, they didn't have a problem technically baking matzah. They could bake matzah. They had curfews, but they didn't have the type of starvation, privation that other places had. It wasn't like a camp. But he says, we don't have the ability to harvest our own wheat. So the problem is you go to the store, you can't just go to Jewel and buy a bag of flour today and bake matzah. Because you have to be concerned that perhaps in the factory they wash the flour. That's one concern. And the other concern is what Rabbi Engel spoke about yesterday, about the requirement for Lishma and Shimur. So they're so concerned, what about this din that maybe the flour had been washed earlier? That's what they're worried about. It's really mind-boggling when you think about the shilas that we have and the shilas that they had. So the answer was to this shila is that the Shulchan Aruch says, b'shas hadchak, you can use basically any flour. And in this particular area, they didn't generally wash the flour, and therefore you didn't have to worry about it. But to me, the fact that this is what people were thinking about is itself unbelievable. And then the most extreme, which is this third page from the Alei Meroros, that's a sefer I'm going to show you in a second, from Rav Yeshua Aronson. So he has a section in his sefer that I'll show you in a minute of sha'ilas and tshuvas, of questions that came up. This was in a sub-work camp called Buna in Auschwitz. Auschwitz was a major complex, and he was in a particular work camp. First, look at the second column, which is the historical background. And you have in the English from Annette on the backside. This ha'eruah misyachis lekufas shu'usam amachna rikus Auschwitz 4, the sub-camp in Auschwitz, 1944. This is 4 years after he existed. He was in a work camp called Kunin, which we'll see in a minute. He says we have to eat chametz on Pesach because it's pikuach nefesh. Nonetheless, people were not comfortable with that. So they were trying to figure out a way how to be mahadir, how to fulfill the mitzvah of v'chai b'hem in the least offensive halachic way. It's mind-boggling. So what did he say? So on the top, Buna in Auschwitz, Dibarti aleva charedim shebeim ochlim naknik hakarkashos, which is trade, vorch salami, ochametz bepesach, yochlu pachos mikazayas, ubehefsik yosu michadei achilas pras. How should the people eat the tray food and the chametz on Pesach? You should eat less than a kezayis, and how long is the kedei achilas pras? So it's about 7.5 minutes, let's say. That's what the Malamel Hol says. It's somewhere between 4 minutes and 9 minutes. But what happens is, he says, that according to the halacha, if a person takes one bite of matzah, and then they stop, and then they take another bite of matzah 10 minutes later, and then they take another matzah 10 minutes later after that, that's not eating.
That's like nibbling. You didn't actually eat anything. And therefore, it's not considered to have fulfilled the mitzvah of the mitzvah matzah. So to the opposite. So you can imagine, this is unbelievable. You have Jews who are in a sub-camp of Auschwitz, of all places, in 1944. And the whatever meager amount of chametz they have, they're eating it over the course of less time, just so that they won't be a violation of the Yisr chametz. It's unbelievable. So this is a sampling of Shalos and Tshuvos. Let's move to the salmon-colored pages, which is on the next section. Okay, so Rav Rimon tells the story of Rav Yonah Emanuel. And by the way, Rav Yonah Emanuel's Sefer you can get online. It's available if you have access to something called Otsra Chachma. He tells you the Sefer of Rav Yonah Emanuel, who told over the following mice at the bris of his grandson. And this section is the reflection of the survivors. I would like to tell you what happened 40 years ago today. I was unable to tell the story until now. I never told it to my wife, my children. I never told it to anyone. I was unable to. For the first time, I feel I could tell it now at the bris of my grandson, Aaron Chananel. On the morning before Pesach, in 1945, I left for hard labor in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, as I had done every day for the previous 2 years. Bergen-Belsen is a concentration camp in Germany. I came back at night utterly, totally exhausted, as I did every night during those 2 years. I was 19 years old. My father was already dead. My older brother, Elchanan, was already dead. My younger brother, Shalom, was dead. And my younger sister, Batya, was also not among the living. The Bergen-Belsen camp was not an extermination camp, but a labor camp. And Jews died of unbelievably hard labor, the terrible cold, starvation, and disease. During that time, hundreds of Jews died each day in Bergen-Belsen. For those who have not seen, there are actually footage available now. You can get it online without difficulty of the Allied rescue and liberation of Bergen-Belsen, and the piles of corpses, mind-boggling. He goes to speak to his mother. I went to the hut where my mother was. She was very ill. I sat next to her and began to recite the Haggadah. We had no wine. We had no matzahs. We did not even have bread. We had only one thing in greatest abundance, and that was maror. In our hearts, I whispered the Haggadah, and I was not sure whether my mother heard me or did not hear me. When I came to the blessing of Asher Ga'alanu, and I said the words, so too, Lord our God and God of our fathers, enable us to reach future holidays and festivals in peace, rejoicing in the rebuilding of your city and ecstatic in your service. I felt, for the first time, I did not believe what I was saying. Would any of us there reach future holidays and festivals? Would any of us ever see Jerusalem? Would any of us ever rejoice again? I burst into tears in the middle of the Haggadah. In the middle of the blessing, I stopped reciting the Haggadah. Had I been able to describe to myself on that Pesach Eve of 1945 an iota of what took place today, had I been able to picture to myself that I would be privileged to come to the land of Israel with my sister and my two brothers, that I would be privileged to live in a Jewish country, that I would be able to establish a family, to raise 7 children, to be a tzaddik at the bris of my grandson in Yerushalayim 40 years later, had I been able to imagine any of that, I might have been able to complete the reading of the Haggadah. So it's one thing to be in it, and then it's another thing to reflect on it. And to see that Asher Ga'alanu finally for this family closed. But you see how difficult it was for the people at that time. This is the Sefer called Aleim Roros, and I thank the Spertus Library for not foreclosing my house, because this book is severely overdue. But they haven't come after me yet. So this is the work camp called Kunin, where Rav Aronson, if you look on the second page of this, you actually have the map, Rav Yeshua Moshe Aronson, where he came from, and it's in the clip booklet that says Kunin Work Camp. There are 2 Pesachs that he describes. He arrived in this work camp. You see on the back exactly where he traveled and how long he was in where he went to different camps. He spent a short time in a death camp in Auschwitz. But he was in this work camp from the spring of 1942 until 1943. This book is called Aleim Roros. It's a fascinating work because it combines 2 things. Part of it is a diary that he wrote at the time, which he had lost for a period of time. Then he found it. In addition, right after the war, he wrote down his zichronot. He did survive. He made it to Israel. I think he lived in Petah Tikva. So in the section of the diary, he doesn't have an entry for Pesach. But in the parallel section in the Zichronot that was written shortly after the war, he reflects on the experience of Pesach, because he had two Pesachs in this war camp called Kunin. You see there's a hut on the second page, Tzrif Eitz B'machaneh, that's the barrack that they lived in. And he tells you the most unbelievable story and an amazing vort. You could say this at your Seder table. He says, and the first page is it's actually 1943. The second page where you see the picture of the hut, that's his description of Pesach in 1942. So he says they got together, not just in his hut, there was another rabbi in a different hut where they had packed with people who came to say the Haggadah. And he says, they get to the bracha of Shehechianu and they start to cry. And people are wailing and sobbing. And someone raises their hand and says to Rav Aronson, how can you say Shehechianu? It's a bracha of Atala. That's not a bracha Shehechianu on this. So he responds with an amazing vort. Because a few paragraphs later in the Haggadah, we talk about Ben Zoma and the obligation to remind ourselves of the Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim, the remembrance of going out. Not Sipur, not the story, but the remembrance. We do that every day with Kriyashma. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, wow, until Ben Zoma came along, I didn't have the merit to say Yetzias Mitzrayim every night in Shema, when it says at the end of the Parsha, Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. Then Ben Zoma taught us. How did he know it? So the Haggadah says, Kol Yemei Chayecha, Yemei Chayecha Hayamim, Kol Yemei Chayecha Halelos, said Rav Aronson in a barrack to broken Jews. He says, Yemei Chayecha Hayamim, those are the shiny days. Those are the good days of our life. So then we could say the Haggadah. Then we can be Zocher Yetzias Mitzrayim. But until Ben Zoma came along, we didn't realize that we were capable, or obligated, it was part of who we are, to mention Yetzias Mitzrayim even Balelos, even at night. Right now, he says to his fellow prisoners, he says, this is the night. And yet, we are still obligated in the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. And he says, that's why we're going to say the Seder, we're going to say the Haggadah tonight. Unbelievable. That's what he writes in this paragraph on Birchas Shehechianu. The next page that you have, this is called Sinai. Sinai is an important Torah periodical. This was published in the 50s. There was a survivor of the Vilna Ghetto. And he's reflecting on an unbelievable Mesiras Nefesh. So he's talking about the Vilna Ghetto and what it was like preparing for Pesach. The biggest takeaway that I had from this piece is something unbelievable. He says, obviously it was very difficult in the ghetto to get ready. They were able to bake matzahs, but it was very difficult. On the fourth line, Ah ulam hayu anashim, there were men. Shemonu mipiem b'meshech Yerachim Arukim, Eskol Asher Itzlichu Lahavriach Be'ezo Ofen Shuel HaGetto L'man Tien Lahem BePesach Matzos BeMidah Mesepekes. There was a distribution of matzah. Everybody got a tiny bit of matzah that was being distributed in the ghetto. But he says there were some people, imagine this, who started thinking in January, how am I going to have enough matzah on Pesach? So whatever they could smuggle into the ghetto, whatever they could squirrel away, they weren't eating it today. They were malnourished and they were starving. No. These Jews, he describes, were saving it in their pocket so that they could barter it before Pesach to have adequate matzah. Unbelievable. Lo ye'uman ki yesupar. That's what he describes. That's what he remembers from the Vilna ghetto. And then the Warsaw ghetto, which is this last piece. These are recollections from Yad Vashem, different people thinking about, reflecting on a very famous Pesach Seder, and that was in 1943, the Pesach Seder in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Warsaw Ghetto uprising began on Erev Pesach, and that is described, I should get the book from over here, hold on a second, it's on the wrong table. That's described in this volume. Also, soon to be returned at some point to Spertus, by Dr. Hillel Seidman. Hillel Seidman was an archivist, not formally part of the Onik Shabbos archives, but he was closely connected with people in the Onik Shabbos archives. And he's an amazing historian and a scholar of what was going on in the ghetto at that time. It's incredible. He describes the personalities. This was originally published, I think it was called Yoman Beghetto Varsha. Then, now it's published called The Warsaw Ghetto Diaries by Feldheim, but it's nearly, I shouldn't say nearly impossible, but it's extremely difficult to get a hold of this book, so I don't own it. But it's an amazing description of the day-to-day living, which he himself wrote down at that time, his experience at that time. And you had other people who are, this was written contemporaneously, which is why it's on that, we'll get back to it in a second. But he describes how that morning of Erev Pesach, the battle for the Warsaw Ghetto began, and how there was a Seder at that midnight. He tells you how Rav Menachem Zemba, a great Gaon and rabbinic leader, major giant, who held a Seder at 7 Kopika Street, including, and he gives you exactly the names, the people who experienced the Seder that night. And you have lots of other survivors, which are on this salmon-colored sheet, who remember that night, who experienced the Seder night then. If you want to just take one moment to think about who Rav Menachem Zemba was. Rav Menachem Zemba was a prodigious Torah giant. He lived in a small suburb of Warsaw called Praga, not Prague, Praga. He was known as the Prager Ela. He was an orphan. He was raised by the Ger Hasidic community in Warsaw. And when he was killed on Shabbos Chol HaMoed during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. He had lost much of his life's work. We have two slim volumes that he published that we still have. One is called Zera Avram, the other one is called Totzos Chaim. So when I had a chance in one of our schools to talk about the Holocaust and Rav Menachem Zemba, I asked the students, it was a girls' class in Ari Crown, I asked them to bring me a stack of textbooks. I asked them to bring me as many as they could carry. So we stacked up a list of textbooks about this high. I said, we want to get to 10,000 pages in the textbooks. I said, because this is the number of manuscripts that Rav Menachem Zemba had written that were destroyed in the ghetto. 10,000 pages, which Simon describes part of the reason he did not want to leave the ghetto, because this was his life's work. He had an entire pirush on all of Rambam and all of Yerushalmi. 10,000 pages, all destroyed. But he was still living, and he held the Seder that night that's being described here by the survivors. Okay, we move from the survivor table to the experience at the time, to the next table. So on this table... Thank you. On this table, we're looking at four different pieces. I left my notes. I want to introduce you to someone whose picture you can find readily online. I didn't bring it with me today. He was a rabbinic figure, an amazing personality. He was murdered by the Nazis. His name is Rav Shimon Huberband. Shimon Huberband was the one religious member, the rabbinic member, so to speak, of the Onik Shabbos Archives. The Onik Shabbos Archives was organized by Emanuel Ringelblum to document what was going on in the Warsaw Ghetto on an ongoing basis. Emanuel Ringelblum survived the ghetto and then escaped, and then when he was... when he was out of the ghetto, he came back. Then he was caught and he was killed. But this individual, this great hero of Shimon Huberband, was responsible for categorizing the religious life in the ghetto, which is in itself an entire world to focus on. So they were able to recover, you know, they buried various pieces of the Onik Shabbos archives in different places in the ghetto, and this piece was also found. So originally appeared in a Hebrew version, and now this is in the English version called Kiddush Hashem, Jewish Religious and Cultural Life in Poland During the Holocaust. Shimon Huberband, it's translated by Gurak, I think. So there are so many amazing things about this work. Just to realize who he was and the significance of his role in the ghetto, there is a eulogy that was devoted to him in memory of our dear friend Rabbi Shimon Huberband, member of the Onik Shabbos Archives, This was November 5th, 1942. They have here first in the top the memorial to him by one of the members of the Onik Shabbos archives. And then in the footnote, they actually have a little tribute to him by Emanuel Ringelblum himself. Says the following. Ringelblum wrote the following. The loyal father and provider for the group was the ailing but still warm-hearted Menachem Cohn. He rescued both Hirsch and Rabbi Huberman from typhoid fever, cared for them, etc. So this Rabbi, I'm sorry, he's writing about Rabbi Menachem, who's writing about Ringelblum. 2 years ago, when Dr. Ringelblum and the writer of these lines, which is this Menachem Cohn, founded an archival team, was called due to political reasons Onik Shabbos. Rabbi Huberman became its most accomplished member. His materials from nearly all of the cities and towns in Poland deal with the cruelty of the German murderers and the hardships and pain which Jews suffered. The writer of these lines spent several hours almost daily discussing Onik Shabbos affairs with Huberman. With the deepest conscience, I state that our dear friend was one of the most wonderful personalities of our time. He was devoted with heart and soul. Archival work was not a difficult task for him. He worked at it with dedication both day and night. 2 hours before Hitler's bestial murder sent him and his wife off to Treblinka death camp, he spoke with me about a plan he had for the Onik Shabbos. We spoke in the brush factory where both of us worked, believing that it would save us from shameful deaths. So this is Menachem, I think his name was Cohn, I forget his name, writing about Shimon Huberman. So Shimon Huberman has an entry about Pesach in the ghetto in 1940. That is parallel to this entry that you have on your page, which is from a book called Scroll of Agony, which is another diary, not a member of the Warsaw Ghetto Archives, not a member of the Onik Shabbos, and by the name of Chaim Kaplan. These two things kind of fit together. I only gave you one of them, but they give you a perspective on what life was like in the ghetto in 1940, because it's kind of a strange thing for us to imagine. On the one hand, ghetto life was miserable. People were terribly impoverished. There was hunger. People were dying in the streets. At the same time, there was some modicum of like regular life that was going on. People were buying and selling. There were marketplaces. You could see photographs. If you go on Yad Vashem, they have an extensive archives of photographs that are available that you can get online. When we started, those who picked up the white pictures of the Siddurim that were taking place in the ghetto, so those pictures I got from the Yad Vashem archives, you can access them. But what's amazing is they both describe how there was a festive environment, there was a festive atmosphere on Pesach in 1940, even though they were trapped in the ghetto. Now, Shimon Huberman points out that part of it had to do with the fact that at that time, Germany was fighting in Belgium and Holland, and there were false reports that Germany was losing the war. So, no, I'm good, thank you. So that may have contributed to the reason why people felt so elated about Pesach. But even that notwithstanding, if you look at the bottom of this diary entry, and what's so powerful, I think, about the materials on this table is that these are not reflections of survivors, which are valuable in and of themselves, of course. This is written at that time by the people who experienced it. So they have, he has a whole, on the left side, he has a whole description of the beginning, the preparations for Pesach. And then on the bottom, see where the second paragraph to the end. In every Jewish home, the signs of the holiday are manifest. Perhaps not in dress, but everyone has brought the holiday specialties to the extent he could afford. Amazing. A sty in the devil's eye. But the truth could not be concealed. One factor which has not been mentioned helped greatly in the holiday preparation, and that is the joint. And that's a separate discussion about the various efforts of the community that got together. But it's amazing to think about. Sman Chayrusenu, even though they were in a ghetto, they were still celebrating. There were still Siddurim that were going on. So that's in the Warsaw Ghetto. In Krakow, I turn your attention to this page. It says Archeon Yad Vashem on the front of it. I have my handwritten scratch on the bottom. So this is a Haggadah. And I had an unbelievable chus this year. So when I went to Yerushalayim, to to recruit for our kolo for the coming year. So I spent 2 days in Israel, and I had a chance to spend a couple of hours in Yad Vashem. And the archivists were incredibly helpful, and I picked up some just absolutely amazing things. So this is a Haggadah that was written like on trash paper by two men, Natan Gross and Yosef Bau, in Krakow, Pesach 1942. So I don't speak any Polish, which is why I can't tell you what the words actually say, except that I can read the Hebrew transliteration. So for example, on the inside, you see on the top it says Gross, Bau, Krakow. There's some introduction in Polish. NG probably stands for Natan Gross. Title, Haggadah, H-A-G-A-D-A. Then it says, I don't know what it is. Bottom left, you see where it says Halach Ma'anya. Top of the next column in Polish, Manishtana, S-Z-S-T-A. Moving forward, Avodim Hayinu, Hayinu, H-A-J-I-N-U. But what does it say? Niulinkani, Bliss, I have no idea. You, then what does it say? Hitler, we getcha. We were slaves to Hitler in the ghetto. Avodim Hayinu L'Parav B'Mitzrayim, we're slaves to Hitler in the ghetto. This is the Haggadah that was written in Krakow, in the Krakow ghetto. And then, you see something even more amazing. Go to the next page. What are the 10 makos? 10 plag. Ghetto. Robati. OD. Judenrat. SS. Etc. Those are the 10 makos. Those are the 10 makos that they were experiencing in the Krakow ghetto. So on the one hand, they were experiencing the Seder. On the other hand, the Seder took on a whole different meaning in the Krakow ghetto. I now turn your attention to this page. Some of them it came out white. This little packet, which I thank Rabbi Stromer for. He shared this Haggadah with me. This is amazing. There was a Belzer Chassid who lived in a Hungarian town called Chop. I tried Googling where this place is. You really need somebody who knows how to spell something in Hungarian, because if you write Chop Yiddishized, it's not going to be easy to find. So this was a man who was close to the Hasidic dynasty of Belz in the Hungarian and Galicianish area, his family. And he was clearly a very, very, very learned man, although his occupation was he had a shop. It describes here in the beginning, he had a store. And during the war, I don't know if he started before the war or during the war, he compiled a Haggadah. But not any Haggadah. You have on the front page of your packet the Sharblat of what this Haggadah looked like. This is the handwritten copy, which you have on the front of your packet. Haggadah Shel Pesach, Beis Aaron, and Beis Avram. You see that? That's his handwriting. So this is the way that he laid it out. He hand wrote it. It's beautiful writing. But you'll notice there are several different commentaries. Because he writes in the Sharblat, he wrote 1, 2, 3, 4 Haggadah commentaries in the section called Beis Aaron, and then another 5 Haggadah commentaries, each in a different style, called Beis Avram. So when you open the Haggadah, you will see different sections with different titles. So he has a section called Chochmas Aaron, Binas Aaron, Brechos Becheshbon, Ruach Hadasha. So he basically wrote 7 commentaries, or 8 commentaries, however many it is, in one volume that he had in this paper, like pile of papers, this manuscript that you see in front of you. You are looking at it. And he was carrying around with him until he knew somebody who had a family member who had access to a bunker, who he gave it to them, who they put it in a bunker. He was murdered, but afterwards, somehow, some member of their family was able to, that's a whole other story in the beginning, in the introduction of this Haggadah, was able to unearth it. And then they sent it to a relative of theirs in Israel, and then it was published. So what's amazing about this Haggadah is not just the fact that it is an incredibly fabulous Haggadah, but you can get a sense a little bit from some of the Divrei Torah, from what's going on in the Haggadah, about what's going on beyond the Haggadah. So for example, if you look on the first page, after the Sharblat, you have a section called Harachamon hu yivarech es avi mori. So when we bench, let's say in our house, we bench out loud, so we sing the Harachamons, and then it gets quiet, so everybody can bench the Harachamon for their parents, for their in-laws, for whoever it is. What does he do in the Haggadah? When he says, Harachamon hu yivarech es avi mori, Hashem should bless my father, he spends the next paragraph, which we're not going to do now, but you can look at it later, telling you, well, this is my father. And this is what happened to him. And this is where he was in a labor camp. And this is where he died. You don't find that in too many Haggadahs. Because his father died, so he gives him like a little paragraph to explain to him who he was and what his life was about. And then he has an amazing vart. Go to the next page. Again, here you have a Dvar Torah. This is not written 50 years later. This is written at that time. Amazing vart. So, if you look on the bottom of that page, on the Harachamon Yishlach Lano Es Elio Hanavi, so he quotes a vort from Reb Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev. Because the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, why is it that, because the Gemara says, Sha'alu l'mashiach ema sayavo, it's on the bottom of page 1, then we'll skip to page 2. Ve'eshiv hayom im b'kol tishmo, when will Mashiach come? Today, if you'll listen. So the Gemara says, how could that be? But Elio HaNavi didn't come yesterday. And the Gemara has a tradition. It's from Navi and Halachi. Malachi, I think we just read it yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. So Elio HaNavi comes first, Mashiach comes the next day. So he says, I don't understand. Why does Elio HaNavi come a day before Mashiach? So he quotes a vort from the Bartitchever like this. He says, well, you know, look, Jews, we're really busy. We got stuff going on. We got business. We got carpool. We got community affairs. Imagine if Mashiach came right now. We'd be like, oh, you know, my kid has a birthday party at 10:30, which is true. And then my other kid has baseball. And then I have a chavrusa. It's like, it's very nice that Mashiach came today. But you know, if he would have given us 24 hours notice, we would have cleared the calendar and would have been able to deal with Mashiach. So says the Bartitchever, that's why Elio HaNavi has to come first. Elio HaNavi will come, and everybody's like, oh, now we can handle it. So what does he say? But he says, go to page 4. Oh no, page 3, the last one. He says, in the end of the bracket, V'hine kol zeh haya bizmaneim. That was true in the old days, says Rev Aaron Avram Friedman, this Belzer Chassid, Hashem Yikom Damo, was murdered. Shahu true to this game, everybody had work. Look, today, who goes to work? We all go to labor. The Sagra Chanuyos, they close the stores. We have nothing. People aren't busy now. Imkain, therefore, he says, Yechola gam kain lios biyash Mashiach hayom. You don't need Elio HaNavi. And so when we say, Harachamon Yishlach Lanu as Elio HaNavi, says no. Today, we should really be saying, Harachamon Yishlach Lanu, Mashiach Tzidkenu. What a vart. But look, it's just amazing. This is a man whose whole world is being destroyed around him, but he views it in this religious way of trying to relate to the Ribbono Shel Olam, of trying to fit his world into the world of the spirit, into the world of learning that he knows from before. This is amazing. And then, the last piece is something that I want to introduce you to. It also says Yad Vashem on it. So this, in Yad Vashem, it's in an archives from Dr. Mayer, or Mark Davernowski. I'm very bad with Polish names. So it's hard to read on the front cover, but this is Xerox that I got from Yad Vashem. On the top it says B47.3. So I'm going to give you the backstory from this, because now this has become a very popular thing, apparently, for those people who have social media. I don't know anything about social media, but for people who are into it, apparently this is going on all around, whatever, Twitter, Tumblr, whatever, Facebook, Echves.
You're speaking to the right
cat. Right, yeah. So this is going around, but what we were able, with a little bit of research, you can find out the backstory of something that's amazing. So this page in front of you is it's like the cover page from Yad Vashem. The way it works is you go there, and you don't have to pay them anything except if you want a Xerox and take home. You have to leave your backpack outside, which I can understand, for they don't want, God forbid, somebody should take something. You go in, and they're extremely helpful. And you could search, and then you give them a list. You say, I want, you know, this kind of stuff. They take it to the back room, and then they have like a dumbwaiter, like a little freight thing. They put the paper in, it goes down to the basement. They must have like Oompa Loompas in the basement down there. Then they come back up, and they give you a whole stack of things. So they sent me up, this is the cover page of a prayer. Now in the bottom, in the hand scroll, that's not mine, it's theirs, Nimsar al Yedei Yosef Freihan. This is given to Yad Vashem from the archives of this doctor on the top, but it was given over by Yosef Freihan, who was in Bergen-Belsen, who said this prayer with other prisoners before Pesach 1944. Who wrote this prayer? What we're about to read. He tells you, Tfilo zu chubra b'safa ha'ivris al yedei Harav Levinson. Who is Harav Levinson? Who is this man? So if you look on the next page, so Yad Vashem has a database where they're kind of, I guess, the equivalent of death certificates. Here we have him. There was a huge transport of Dutch Jews who had been at a concentration camp called Westerbork initially, and then transferred to Bergen-Belsen. And one of them is this great Rav, Rav Avram Levinson, born in The Hague, the Netherlands, in 1902. He was then taken to Bergen-Belsen, and you see exactly, he died on his way from the last transports. He was going from Bergen-Belsen to Theresienstadt, and he died. So this is one Dutch rabbi who was together with another group of Dutch rabbis, a couple of them. The next one, you'll see, we have a picture of him. This comes from an incredible encyclopedia, which now I am indebted to a member of this community who, I don't know how much time and effort and money he spent, but he showed up at my door with all 7 volumes of this encyclopedia as a gift called Ela Ezkera. It was published in the early 1950s by, I think, the father of Nat Lewin, who collected the rabbinic biographies of hundreds of figures. And one of them, you see the picture right here, Rav Aaron Yisachar Davids of Rotterdam. Chief Rabbi of Rotterdam. Then he gives you in the Ela Ezkera his background and his biography. That's on page 5. And now on page 6, here's the tefillah. It comes from the Ghetto Fighters Museum in Tel Aviv. It's all over social media now. But if you took the time, which we don't have now because we start a little bit late, you can understand the backstory of who these people were. Where did this come from? You're talking about Jews who were in Westerbork for an extended period of time, who were then sent to Bergen-Belsen. They're there in 1944, and this is before many of them were sent along from Bergen-Belsen to Theresienstadt. And the tefillah itself is incredible. Incredible. Lefnei achilas chametz yomrik v'kavona saleh. Before eating chametz on Pesach, you should say the following with kavona. Avinu shabash shemayim. Our Father in Heaven. Hine goloi v'yodua lefanecha. It is known before you. Shiritzoneinu lasos ritzoncha. We want to do the wishes of Hashem. V'lochol keschag ha-pesach ba'achilas matzah. We want to eat matzah. And b'shmiras iser chametz. And not to eat chametz. Ach, but al zos do'ava libeinu. We're depressed. That what? Shahashibud Ma'akivosana. We're prisoners. We don't have any matzah here in Bergen-Belsen. Va'anachnu nimtzoim besakanas nefashos. It's life and death. So what's the halacha in life and death? Pikuach nefesh. So what do you have to do? You got to break them all except for the big 3. So now he says, for chassidim, when we sit down to do a mitzvah, we say, hinenu muchanu mezuman. We're preparing ourselves to say a preparation to really get in the zone to fulfill the mitzvah with the fullest kavanah. So he says, mamish, unbelievable. Hinenu muchanu mezuman lakai mitzvah secha v'chai bahem. Now we're going to eat we're going to eat chametz, and that's a mitzvah. So we're getting ourselves ready to fulfill the mitzvah of achilas chametz bePesach, because that's v'chai b'hem. V'lizor mehara asharascha, and to be cautious about what you said. Hisham lecha ushmonafshcha ma'od. Be careful and watch yourself. Guard yourself. Al kein, therefore, tefilaseinu, our prayer. What is our prayer? What are people thinking? I'm not saying everybody is thinking this, but you see, this is what people are doing. It's unbelievable, the Mesiris Nefesh. Who could imagine? Tefilaseinu lecha, our prayer to you, God. Shetchayenu uskaymenu usigaolenu b'mehera lishmor chukecha v'lasus sonechu lo'avtcha v'leva shalem. Amen. Amen. All right, we're going to close with the green sheets with the post-war Haggadah. Okay, this Haggadah is called the Survivor's Haggadah. It's an incredible work, and it's not difficult to get. You can buy this used online. I just got this. It's called The Survivor's Haggadah. It's published by JPS. It's published by JPS, what was it? In 2000, by Sal Tauster, which is, his background is a whole interesting story in and of itself. This is a Haggadah that was written in Munich in 1946. What you have on the front of yours, of the green sheets, is the tricolor. You don't get tricolor in this, but it's the tricolor A of the American Third Army. It looks like this. This is what it looked like. It was published by a man by the name of Yosef Dov Scheinson, who was a survivor, who was an active Zionist, and it was published by a Zionist group. And he got a hold of several woodcuts of an anonymous artist. Turns out, they found out afterwards who this artist was. His name was Miklos Adler from Hungary, who had made a bunch of woodcuts. I think he made 16 in all, but he only used several of them from this Haggadah. So you could see the way that this book is laid out. It's called The Survivor's Haggadah. The left side is the original Haggadah that you have in your packets, and then the right side is the translation and the explanation. So you have several woodcuts. The two of them both survived the war and never met each other. Yosef Dov Scheinson never knew who made these woodcuts, and Miklos Adler never knew that they had been included in this Haggadah. But this Haggadah gives us a whole nother perspective, a whole nother way of thinking about what the experience was like for the people who lived there and then survived themselves. So if you look on the inside of the front cover, you see how the illustrations tell you a lot about what they were thinking. You see where it says, there was an introduction in the original volume that I didn't give you from a chaplain, American chaplain by the name of Rabbi Abraham J. Klausner. And if you want to read more about this Haggadah, the book is terrific. But you see where it says, Browse Bad. Browse Bad means shower bath. So you see on the top? We were slaves to Hitler in Germany. Again, the same motif. Avodim Ayinu Lefar B'Mitzrayim. It's the complexity of the experience. It's the challenge of being able to live in the past of Avodim Hayinu and also come to grips with the present. So if you look at the drawings, what do you see here? You see on the top, Browse Bad, what's that? That's the gas chambers. Top left, you see the skull, and then to the left of that, what do you see? Smokestacks. That's crematory. That's on the inside of the drawing of the Haggadah. And then on the right side, if you could see, there's a knife. And then on the bottom, there are flames. So that's what people were feeling. That's what they were experiencing. So then, I didn't give you the scene in the pack, I didn't give you the whole thing. But then it's very much a traditional Haggadah. So it's kind of like in between. It's living in the past as a Haggadah Pesach service, but then it's living in the present. If you look on the next page, then he has the Manishtana. Avonim Ayinu Lefar B'Mitzrayim. What's the woodcut that he puts here? What do you see? It's the picture of people who are forced laborers digging trenches. Around and around digging trenches. That's the picture in people's minds of Avodim Ayinu Lefar B'Mitzrayim. And then, if you fast forward, something awesome and horrifying. Again, this Haggadah has, we could do a whole shiur just on this one Haggadah. It has Zionist elements of going on Aliyah. Go to the next page, which is Dayenu. How does Dayenu work for the survivors for 1946?
Dayenu. Ilu pizronu ben hagoyim velo nasan lanu gzeros masa hatzlav harishon dayenu. Had God scattered us among the nation and not given us the Crusades, it would have been enough. Had He given us the first Crusades and not given us the next Crusades, that also would have been enough. V'chulei. Had He not given us blood libels and then the third Crusades, I'm skipping down. Had He not given us the 1903 massacre in Ukraine, 1919, excuse me, that would have been enough. Ilu nasan lanu es hashchitos beUkraine v'lo nasan lanu es Hitler, dayenu. Ilu nasan lanu es Hitler v'lo hikimu lanu ghettos, dayenu. Had He given us Hitler without the ghettos, that would have been enough. Ilu hikimu lanu ghettos v'lo hikimu lanu ta'ei gazim v'chevshunim, dayenu. Had He given us ghettos without gas chambers, that would also have been dayenu. And he goes on. Had they given us gas chambers but not abused our women and children, it would have been enough. So how does he conclude, this Zionist activist? So instead of saying, Alachas kama v'chama tovu chupelas, he concludes, Alachas kama v'chama, on the bottom of the page, Mishigi alonu kol eila, hari anu chayovim, lalos, lahapil, lachaselas, hagolos, livnos, es eretz abachiru, lakayim, bey, L'chaim bayis lanu ulevanenu ad olam. So what do we need to do? We need to go on aliyah, whatever we can do. Which, Rav Shechter Shlita used to tell us stories that there were people who afterwards they had to fill out cards in DP camps. Where do you want to go? Some people came to America, some people went to Australia, some people went to England, but there were many Jews. They had wrote on their DP cards, choice one, Palestine. Choice two, Auschwitz. Because that was the only place to go. So for a lot of people, the idea of Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim, it took on, in light of the Shoah, a whole new meaning, a whole new experience. So to summarize, what I wanted to try to portray today in a little bit of a, maybe it's a little intense, but a little bit of a different motif, is that you see, at that time, when we dealt with the blue sheets, you see the devotion and the piety of people, and how their aspirational Yiddishkeit can affect us. You know, for us, we wonder, you know, we think maybe we should cut a little corner over here, maybe we have to push ourselves for this, for that. You listen to the shayles that they're asking, it's just unbelievable. It's really a machayev. It should make us think about how we relate to our Yiddishkeit. How committed are we? Listen to how they were committed. The second section, the salmon color pages, were the reflections, where the way that people thought back about that experience at that time. And then the off-white, which I think to me are the most powerful, the most impactful, are the contemporaneous documents, are the way that people experienced it at that time. Because memory and history, both very interesting and important, but there's nothing like primary documents. There's nothing like what was written at that time. And then you conclude where you see the effect that it had on people and how they needed to struggle with it, how they needed to deal with it. So this is one example of a way, and this was published many, many times in Siddharm that were led in different places, of how they were coming to grips with the complexity of believing and still having a Seder, which is itself a great miracle, but at the same time trying to come to terms with it, put it into a you know, for a Zionist, has to do with going in Aliyah, dealing with the experience that they had and fitting it into, you know, the woodcuts are a good example of that, of taking the traditional Haggadah, and even the language in the Haggadah that you'll find here, you've got some Hebrew, you've got some Yiddish, you have stories that are interwoven. So for these people, the Haggadah, the Seder, was never the same. And the question is, how do we take the inspiration and the chizuk from the way that they experienced it and gave to us so that we can pass that along to future generations? I wish everyone a Chag Kasher V'Sameach.